Professor Allen's Comics Reading Journal for the month of July, 2022. Welcome to episode 86 of this podcast series. And the concept of the show is to just have a brief chat about what comics I've read since the last time we had one of these brief chats, which should make this pretty much, actually pretty close, to the books I read during July. These books are listed weekly in blog posts at eyesandearsblog.blogspot.com, and I regularly repost them on my Facebook and Twitter, so you can find those. But those posts are not spoilers for this podcast, because those are just lists. And here, there's a little more review, a little more critique, a little more discussion. But first, a little feedback. And we start with one more piece of feedback about comic book grab bags. This one came in from Bon, Jack Bon. And somehow, my record keeping, let's say, became imperfect. So I don't think I've covered this feedback before, but I'm not 100% sure. On the question of repeated issues in blind bags, Jack says, I guess the odds of that all come down to a simple question. How many issues did they need to get rid of? I was listening to your episode hoping you would give at least one of the copies of Secret Defenders 9 a chance to prove itself to you. From the issues I've read, I doubt it will. But you must uphold the academic tradition of double Secret Defenders probation. Thank you, Jack, and no spoilers, but just keep listening to the episode, because maybe, just maybe. And then on to May books for hashtag Crime Comics Month. For that, we heard from Sir Luke Giaconetti. Professor, as we all know, crime does not pay. Crime comics, however, seem to have paid off quite well in this inaugural Crime Comics Month. Like you, I read the Gordon's Law miniseries, featuring everyone's, and I do mean everyone's, favorite four-color top cop. The other two minis collected in the trade paperback, Batman GCPD and Gordon of Gotham, also did a wonderful job of scratching the police procedural itch. GCPD especially seems like a pilot for the ongoing, a series of which I was aware during its run but never actually read. In addition to that highly recommended Gordon of Gotham trade, I also read the first volume of a Franco-Belgian series entitled IR S, although the S is a dollar sign, so I do not know how to pronounce that. Volume 1, Luke continues, is called Taxing Trails, which sees IRS agent Larry Max unravel a mystery which dates back to World War II, when the death of a banker gets the attention of the Secretary of the Treasury. A very Ian Fleming sort of adventure tale, with car chases, shootouts, and a legitimately engaging mystery. You can find IR dollar sign on Hoopla, and I do intend to read more of the series, part of a large collection of Euro comics on the service thanks to publisher Cinebook. I was amused by your mentioning of Captain Power. What a weird show this was. A live-action toy tie-in that was co-created by Gary Goddard, director of the live-action Masters of the Universe film. And sporting JMS as the head writer, the show is marketed to children as an interactive game. The toy line included a jet, which was a type of light gun, which would interact with the early computer animation of the show, allowing for a simplistic game. Amazingly, for a show based around interactive toys, featuring a hero named Captain Power, battling a villain named Lord Dredd, the show was written with an adult audience partly in mind. The intent was for the show to appeal to both kids and their parents, and ultimately, it failed on both counts. I remember commercials for the toy line, but I'm not sure I've ever seen a single episode, and I know that I've never read the comic. So your comments really dredged up some old neurons. Thanks for all the miscellany. As always, I remain your devoted listener, Sir Luke. Thank you, Luke. Yes, the more I've learned about Captain Power, the more I am amazed by the whole thing. And also, yes, those James Gordon stories, especially the ones written by Chuck Dixon, are excellent, and I definitely have to read that IR dollar sign. And on Adventure Comics from last month, Luke commented, "Let me tell you of the days of high adventure." And we heard from poor Gene Hendricks, who plaintively asked through his tears, "Why did you mention Quarterbit episode 100? So sorry, Gino. By the way, have you considered therapy for the trauma brought about by recording that episode? I'm just saying, it couldn't hurt, man. It couldn't hurt. Manuel Carmona from Truthful Comics said it was a nice episode. Thank you. I listened to it yesterday as I went for a walk. Glad to hear you're getting in your steps, Manuel. Sir Dr. Ange said it sounded like a great month of comics. As I've told you, I have come a bit full circle on Supergirl's death in Crisis. At the time, I was pretty irate that the folks at DC would think she was expendable. However, since her return to the DCU and her presence therein, both in comics as well as other media, the live-action TV show, DC Superhero Girls, I think it's great that her character history has such a defining moment, such a legacy. I mean, she comes within a cat's whisker of defeating the Anti-Monitor on her own. And let's face it, the image people think of when you mention Crisis is the cover of number 7, and she died a hero there, sacrificing herself to save Superman and the multiverse. I can deal with that. As for what Riverdale could stand for in The Man from Riverdale, how about Registered, Intelligent, Vicious, Erudite, Roguish, Determined Agents Lacking Ethics? You know, Doc, that's not bad, especially considering that Reggie and Veronica are parts of the team. And Sir Martin thanked me for sharing my latest month of comics. Of the comics you read, that I've read, my faves are Scooby-Doo Batman and The Flash Super Spectacular. I'm glad your eyes have been open to Arrak, Son of Thunder. It's 50 fantastic issues. Good news, the story from Skull the Slayer's final issue was continued in Marvel 2-in-1, number 35, and it's on Marvel Unlimited. I'm looking forward to hearing how Western Comics Month goes. If I may make a suggestion, this is on the DC app. Great characters and an amazing creative team. And the book that Mart linked to was Brave and the Bold 171, teaming up Batman and Scalp Hunter. Well, Mart, I'd say you just wait about, I don't know, I guess maybe 20 minutes or so, and we'll see if I got to that one. Social media support for last episode came from Shane Kelly, James Williams, Vic from Phoenix, Chris Willett, Trevor Owen Williams, It's Jason, Billy D from Magazines and Monsters, The Kind and Lovely Sutherlands from Trekker Talk and other rad podcasts, Chris from Professor Frenzy, you're welcome, Drew from Comics for Fun and Profit, Clinton from The Days of High Adventure, Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, Jeremiah the Notorious, JJG, Radioactive Dinosaur, The Telltale Mind, Big Easy 77, Bill at Spy Vinyl, Jennifer F., Herman from the Long Box of Darkness, Chris Lydon 7, and the Lady Laurel from the Huntress podcast. So now, let's move on to the books that I read last month. As we do on this show, we categorize the books that I read, and first up are those I read specifically for podcasts, the homework books, and for an upcoming episode of Doomspeak, I read What If Volume 2, Issue 52, in which we learn just how glorious existence would truly be if only Victor Von Doom would become Sorcerer Supreme. And comics I read for listening to podcasts, and they're getting to be a good number of these most months because of the DC Infinite app, and I love following along with comic book podcasts when I have that chance, and the app gives me that chance more often. And also, thanks to you, DC Comics themed podcasters. Such as the Lady Laurel, a.k.a. Mountain Flower, who along with her crew, on episodes 184 to 186 of Feathers and Foes, covered Birds of Prey 7 through 9, the Death of Oracle storyline. In addition to those issues, I read Nightwing and Huntress number 1 to follow along with the Huntress podcast, episode 79. And a listen with the new Batman Family Reunion podcast. I read Batman Family 7, featuring a Robin-Batgirl team-up, them going up against the villain team of the Huntress, the bad one this time, and Sportsmaster. This wasn't a great story, but it was tons better than the Batman reprints about Dr. Double X and the broken trophies in the Batcave. And to listen along with Ed Moore on the Lords of Order, a Dr. Fate fan podcast, I read JLA number 30 from all the way back in 1964, wrapping up the crossover of the JLA and JSA as they team up to battle the crime syndicate. And for listening along with Shag, I know, what was I thinking? On his Justice League International blah, blah, blah podcast, I read Justice League America 48, the midpoint of the Captain Glory saga. And to listen along to the triumphant return of From Crisis to Crisis, co-hosted by Podcasting's Michael Bailey, the Unnumbered, episode 261, I read Action Comics 726 and Superman, the Man of Steel 61, pushing forward some storylines regarding Clark as the interim editor of the paper, separated from Lois, who's working overseas. Lori Lamaris may be getting into legal trouble, say it ain't so. And the recently married Lex Luthor doing, well, doing Lex Luthor-y type of stuff. And on to the general comic reading that I did, and we start with the new comic right off the digital shelf, which is the latest issue of the Keanu Reeves comic, Berserker! Number 9, where B, in the very distant past, makes contact with the spirit of his father, I think? And in the present, he returns to the military base that has been testing him to go all berserker on that place. And even the woman who's been working closest with him over all this time, it doesn't seem that even she can calm him down. As I've said before about this title, it moves. But this was a solid 3.5 minutes worth of fast-paced, high-quality comic book action. As I talked about on a recent episode of Relatively Geeky Presents, I picked up some grab bags recently. And from those, I read, I had such good feelings about the one issue of this title that I read, I went to Hoopla and grabbed the first four trades. So I read Goldie Vance, 1 through 16 from Boom. This is a teen detective story of which I am a sucker. And a pretty entertaining one at that. This takes place in Florida of the 1960s, although a different one socially from our world. There are characters of all genders and skin tones in all roles and positions in society, including our multicultural heroine herself. She works at her father's hotel, ostensibly as a valet, but spends more of her time working with the hotel detective, sometimes on his cases, sometimes on her own cases, including the case of an astronaut who washes up on the shores of the beach near the hotel. And then she spends some quality time on the pit crew of her mortal enemy's race team in the highest level of international racing, which was a very strange element to see in, you know, a teen detective title. But overall, this was really fun, really adventurous, and I thought quite good. And another one from those grab bags, RoboCop Citizen's Arrest number 3 from Boom 2018, written by Brian Wood. Here's the premise. Detroit is falling apart and the government has lost control. I know. This really strains credulity. But stick with me past this frankly unbelievable setup to the comic itself. And the comic itself is not bad. The original RoboCop having made some changes to his programming to stay off the grid and getting a little human help to do so. Interesting idea. And a series I picked up a number of years ago when a location of Half Price Books was closing down and the dollar bins were at 75% off, so for a total of $1, I read Batman Toyman 1 through 4 from 98, written by Larry Hama. Normally a Superman villain, Toyman ends up in Gotham and gives Batman a run for his money, actually. There is one issue that deserves special mention here, issue 3, which is told from the perspective of the child that Toyman has kidnapped. And since that child is deaf, we get a totally silent issue. And I have to say that other than that element in that single issue, there's not a lot else about the storyline that's really particularly memorable. And continuing a series that I started last year sometime, poking away at the big stack that Kirk Spencer, Big Five Army, sent me. Nexus 13 through 17 from Mike Barron and Steve the Dude Rude. In this one, we see the consequences of Nexus's power. He receives dreams that identify the identity of a murderer, and he has to kill that person. The dreams themselves are very, very, very painful to Nexus. And if he tries to resist or take his time in delivering vengeance, that is also very painful to him. Interesting stuff, although his brooding and attempts to flee his powers and their consequences ran on maybe an issue too long. Now, when he does get back into the swing of things, there is a great issue about him heading to a planet to kill the elected leader. The military sees Nexus's ship approaching, and they know what that means. And the president and his advisors are pretty sure he's coming for him. But the problem is, the president can't admit that publicly. He can't even prepare for the attack. He can't be seen as preparing for Nexus's arrival, as that would be an admission to the public that he is deserving of Nexus's well-known wrath. That was an interesting spin. This series continues to be surprising, and more often than not, surprising in the good way. Continuing another series, one I started a few months back, I read Postal 5 through 8, where we learn a little bit more about just how this town has been kept hidden for so long, including how it stays off of Google Maps and other satellite systems, for example. And our main character, Mark, the mailman with Asperger's, has to decide whether to continue to follow his mom's wishes. His mom is also the mayor and has the entire town wired for constant surveillance, to follow her wishes, or to join up with the cute waitress with the mysterious past in trying to wrest some power away from the mayor, aka Mark's mom. It's a fascinating, weird comic, and I expect to continue along with the series as the year goes by. And from the Dollar Box, at Half Price Books, I read Captain America and the Secret Avengers, a 2011 one-shot featuring Steve running an op where Black Widow and Agent 13 are taking down a bad, bad organization. Good spy stuff, good action, good story. And from the 50-cent boxes at Pulp Reality, I read the all-new, well, it was all-new in 1973, from Charlton, the all-new Drag and Wheels 58, an anthology of car-themed stories, mostly racing cars, or at least driving cars really fast, but not exclusively. One was about why you should never pick up hitchhikers. Although the strangest one was the husband, race car driver, whose wife just doesn't believe he's any good even after he wins at Daytona. I mean, it was a strange conclusion, but maybe that's just the 70s for you. And wrapping up a fantasy series I started earlier in the year, books I nabbed for 50 cents each at Crazy Comics, from Image, Aria, 2 through 4. The concept is that creatures of ancient myth from the fairy realm are in fact all around us. Well, in this case, they are all around us if we live in Manhattan. This one did everything pretty well enough, legit professional work. It was a little tough to get into the world, even though it's a genre I'm familiar with and know a bit about. But even so, it ended up being not great, but good, a solid series. And from the 33-cent box at Carolina Comics and More, I bought and read, and no, I'm not sure why, Fish Police 2 and 3 from 1992. I just did not know what to make of this. It was pretty simple artistic-wise, and also the number of words and the nature of vocabulary were such that this could appeal to younger folk. It seemed to have been designed for that. But other than a few puns, I don't know that they were trying to be funny. They were certainly not succeeding at being funny. And the story itself had a mature, noirish type of thing going, with weirdly adult moments. So I just don't know who this was intended for, except that I can say this with 100% confidence. It was not intended for me. And a combination of the recent Grab Bag episode and from Half Price Books back in the good old days when they had quarter bins, I read The Secret Defenders 1, 2, 3, and 9. There are a lot of books from the 1990s that are criticized, where the extreme 90s-ness is exaggerated for the purpose of making a point. Not every issue is as bad as the worst examples of the excesses of that era. But that being said, these issues are, I suppose, interesting. But I struggle to say that any of them were good, or at least to say that I enjoyed reading them. And from the dime sale at World's Greatest Comics, I read from DC's Helix line, of which I don't know that I've ever read anything, Gemini Blood 1 through 5 of 9, future sci-fi with a touch of dystopia thrown in, of the evil big business variety. The Flickr Wixon Construction Company has found themselves being attacked by Paratwa assassins, beings of superiority of the Gemini blood. I don't know if this was a case of all of Helix's comics, but this one was the development of a novel series by Chris Hintz, although the comics were set a few centuries before the prose books took place. Interesting ideas, but I don't know if they translated to comics as well as other stories do. And some kids' books that I read mostly from Sir Rob Lance and also from Pulp Reality. I read Archie 158 and 179, Life with Archie 100, 111, 170, 223, 224, and 259, Pink Panther 23, Jughead with Archie Digest 131, and Treasure Chest of Fun and Fact, Volume 21, Issues 11 and 18. Life with Archie has always been the title that put the Riverdale squad in different settings, doing different things all around Riverdale. Issue 100 was interesting, as every story involved drag racing, which evidently was a thing in 1970. These older Archie books do give you that interesting viewpoint into what was happening in the broader culture at particular eras. Also from that title, issue 111 stands out as it had a 14-page lead story featuring the band The Archies, and 14 pages is pretty long for an Archie story. And that means that now is the time to take a break, play a promo, and when we get back, it will be time to get out our six shooters and spurs as we get our hashtag Western Comics Month reading going on.
Andy, I have an amazing idea. Let's do a podcast.
We've been talking about doing this for years. That sounds great. So, what should we talk about?
Something no one else is talking about. Batman.
Mike, there are hundreds of Batman shows out there. You used to do one.
True. Well, maybe we could do an index show.
Are you insane? We both already host those.
True again. Okay, maybe we could talk about Batman stories no one else does. Like the Jerry Conway run.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we could discuss his entire run and then go into the Doug Mensch run.
But we won't be tied down to that. We need to be free to talk about other Batman stories from that era as well.
And we could call it the Overlooked Dark Knight, the non-index index show.
Great!
I guess we should do a trailer.
I think we kind of just did.
Yeah, but it's missing something. Like, you should have added music behind us or something.
Andy, I have an amazing idea. Let's do a podcast.
We've been talking about doing this for years. That sounds great! So, what should we talk about?
Something no one else is talking about. Batman.
Mike, there are hundreds of Batman shows out there. You used to do one.
True. Well, maybe we could do an index show.
Are you insane? We both already host those.
True again. Okay, maybe we could talk about Batman stories no one else does. Like the Jerry Conway run.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we could discuss his entire run and then go into the Doug Mensch run.
But we won't be tied down to that. We need to be free to talk about other Batman stories from that era as well.
And we could call it the Overlooked Dark Knight, the non-index index show.
Great!
The Overlooked Dark Knight, the non-index index show. New episodes drop on the 14th and 28th of every month. The show and the website, www.overlookeddarkknight.com, launch in May of 2017 from the Fortress of Baileytude Podcasting Network.
And we're back to talk about seasonal reading, which for July means hashtag Western Comics Month. So prepare yourself for stories about cowboys, shootouts, deputies, owl hoots, and more. These were acquired from a variety of sources, and I'll do my best to identify those as I go. So in approximately alphabetical order, we have, and some months, it's tough to find appropriate books, matching books, for the genre from Archie. And in the past, I have read some of the related Western-themed collections. So this year, I settled on looking at covers of Archie books that seemed to have Western themes, and they were few and far between, at least the ones that I had access to. The best I could do was find a pair of Western-style concepts on the cover. So I ended up reading Archie 324 and 403, one from the mid-80s, and the later one from 1992. We can dismiss the first one, because that just had Archie on the cover in an old-timey, you know, wanted poster, but it had no related, you know, content. 403, on the other hand, was a celebration of the Calgary Stampede, the leading rodeo competition in the world. Archie does his best to woo a Western Canadian gal, but he's not as successful at that as our own good buddy Ranger Gord has been. Archie's best success comes as, no surprise, a rodeo clown. A fun modern story with some old-timey Western elements, and that's about the best I could do for Archie. Following up on a recent Quarterbin podcast with the joyously irrepressible Shag, I continued that New 52 Jonah Hex storyline by reading All-Star Western 24 through 29. Palmiotti and Gray know this character really well, and these are enjoyable stories. Jonah starts in Gotham, where Bruce Wayne helps him get out of some legal trouble, only to head over to Metropolis, where he gets into some Kryptonian trouble. Then his wild girlfriend takes him to the New 52 version of Burning Man. And finally, eventually, Booster Gold shows up to send him and his modern girlfriend back to their time frame, which does not work really well for the modern girlfriend. Also, is Jonah Hex really Jonah Hex if he gets some modern 21st century plastic surgery on his face? Entertaining series of connected stories and the issue-to-issue connections were really, really strong, especially on the app. I just kept rolling from one issue right into the next. And then related, a series we touched on briefly in that episode from the prior Palmiotti and Gray run, Jonah Hex 1 through 5. And these are all standalones, which is so countercultural in terms of how comics were working at that point and still how they work to this day. But right from the start, they nail Jonah's character as the bounty hunter with a heart of gold, or if not a heart of gold, at least a rock-solid sense of ethics and honor. And he's not always the character you want to admit to admiring, but the character is so strong, and Palmiotti and Gray have such a good handle on him, that you do end up, often, kind of on his side. And then, sort of related, if you squint, from that series of DC WB crossovers, the Jonah Hex Yosemite Sam special. The lead story was a serious story, which actually did a good job at placing Sam in the real world as just a small, angry, mustachioed gunfighter. He hires Jonah to protect his claim, and he has possibly struck gold there. The anthropomorphic Foghorn Leghorn was a little harder to buy, although they did their best, bringing him in from the nearby traveling sideshow. Good, gritty story, and then we had a 5 or 6 page silly story, and I actually enjoyed the gritty one a lot more. Vaguely related to that, I guess, is the Best of Bugs Bunny number 2 from Gold Key, 1959. I read this because two of the 5 stories mentioned on the cover related to the Old West. So we're skipping over the story about the fishmen of Atlantis to go straight to Bugs and Porky panning for gold in the Old West and falling in with a crowd of toughs. And then there was also a pretty good story in which Elmer and Yosemite Sam fight over which of them gets to hunt for Bugs. Spoilers, Bugs wins. And an OGN from Humanoids, The Big Country, by Quentin Peoples, more of a modern Western taking place in 1978, but it has all the trappings, the small town, the sheriff, and family secrets. Good read. Glad to have found that one on Hoopla. And from Toby Comics, and then later Charlton, Billy the Kid, 21, 28, 29, and 70. Consistent stories, consistent issues, with issue 70 as my favorite. This one featured a good-sized lead story starring the lead character, who finds himself in the Valley of the Meek, where some good-hearted religious folk have their settlement on some land that is wanted by a whole lot of bad guys with guns, who know about some nearby gold. But Billy's help actually keeps the bad guys from getting the gold and actually buries the gold such that nobody can ever get to it, which actually kind of worked out for everybody. Bouncer, Volume 1, one of the Yodorovsky stories brought to the U.S. by Humanoids. This is the start of a series taking place in the West just as the Civil War has come to an end, and maybe not totally to an end if some of the soldiers have their way. The title character is a one-armed gunfighter, an occasional bouncer, hence the title, at the nearby saloon. In this case, he comes to the rescue of a young boy who stumbles upon a very valuable piece of jewelry. And following Sir Martin's recommendation, which is one of the benefits of being a co-listener of the year, Brave and the Bold, 171. And this is a case of, and I know podcasting's Michael Bailey understands this, what I call F37 syndrome, as in from the 30s to the 70s. Because in that hardcover collection, which I had when I was about 10 years old and still do, Batman was hypnotically sent through time a few times, enough times that I thought that was totally normal, just like it would be normal for Clark Kent to have a mermaid girlfriend when he was in college. Look, we all experiment, okay? Anyway, in this case, he gets hypnotically sent back through time, ending up in the Civil War, fighting alongside and occasionally against Scalp Hunter. And I know what you're thinking, but no, this was not written by Bob Haney, which might be why it holds together really well as a story and was quite delightful. Champions of the Wild Weird West 1-5 from Arcana Comics 2012. This fun little series is best summed up by this comment in issue 4. I send you to rescue a Japanese girl and you come back with an undead Confederate army? We have a fallen samurai, a stolen rail car, and all of that leads to zombies. Wild Weird West. And a Western-themed issue of Classics Illustrated 12, The Adventures of Kit Carson. This one I got from the Dollar Box at World's Greatest Comics. I like the Classics Illustrated comics because they, obviously, differ so widely from one to the other. This one told the story of the small man who became one of the leaders of the Western expansion movement, and we get bits of that political and military history as well. It was a good story, well told. And from Dell from 1960s, 50 cents well spent on a falling apart version of Colt 45 number 5, based not on the beer, but on the TV show Colt 45, of which I was unfamiliar. But the stories were pretty good, especially the second story, in which Captain Colt has to track down a specific missing stallion because the Stallion has war plans hidden in a secret compartment inside one of his horseshoes. Fun story, the way that we moved from scene to scene, I could really see this comic being a TV episode. And a crowd-funded book sent to me by Kirk Spencer, Dead End Moon Number 1, a weird western tale of a cursed lady looking for a secret city of gold, which is also cursed. Look, there's a whole lot of curses in this story, and it was a solid first issue that did what it needed to intrigue me about the following issues. In a complete series from the writing team of Acker and Blacker, Death Be Damned 1-4 from Boom. Again, say it along with me, this is a weird Western story in which a cursed woman is left for dead in the aftermath of the murders of her children and husband. But she can't proceed to her reward till she manages to wreak vengeance against those who wronged her. And that quest for vengeance wreaks havoc on her, actually. I did not like the art in this. For me, at least, it did not help tell the story. And the story itself, I'll be honest, was a bit hard to follow. Again, maybe that was just for me. But I liked the premise and basic outline of the story more than the specifics in how it was delivered. And from a public domain series that I read some of last year, I picked up and read a few more, The Durango Kid, 4-8, based on a series of movies that, again, I am unfamiliar with, but the comics ain't bad. And I can't put my finger on what makes Durango's stories different, but they did seem to me to be a little different. Okay, the one that had the scientist who's developed a nuclear ray gun, that one, I know what makes that one different, because that one was strange. And there were a few backup stories that stand out because of the art. And that's one of the fun things about public domain comics, and that's that you never know who you're going to run across. And in this case, Frank Frazetta shows up as an artist in a number of these issues. And of course, those stories look great. Kid Colt Outlaw, number 72, with three solid stories starring the kid himself. But you know he's the good guy because he doesn't cheat at poker and he helps ladies when they need it. This one was filled out by a strange 3-page story where a man never responds to challenges and is called a coward, only for it to turn out that he's in fact blind. And he does successfully beat up the town bully despite his limitations. And this is a Marvel book. I was waiting for it to be revealed that this was the origin story of an alternate universe Matt Murdock. But sadly, they dropped the ball on that clear bit of continuity. And one that was sent in by the notorious JJG a while back, Jeremiah, from Marvel, The Outlaw Kid, number 9, which are reprints from the 1950s, although this was a 1972 issue. I mentioned the 1950s part because I was fascinated that both the first and the last stories of the four in here both featured bad guys who don't seem to be related to each other at all. But both of these bad guys had the last name of Stark. And similarly to the Kid Colt issue I just mentioned, where they had an amazing fighter who was blind, not related to Matt Murdock, these were clearly not related to Iron Man either. Now, possibly since then, all of this has been retconned, and now they have been welcomed into Marvel continuity, I don't know. But on that Outlaw Kid issue, I did really enjoy that one and quite appreciated that character quite a bit. And from a combo of issues I picked up at Pulp Reality and filled in by the public domain, I read Rex Allen Comics 6-10, featuring the actor and singer Rex Allen, a.k.a. the Arizona Cowboy. Another man, repeat after me, whose work I am not familiar with. But interesting, that the comics are named after him, the performer, and not the character. So these are not Arizona Cowboy comics. They're Rex Allen comics. Now, these ones really did stand out from the pack because the lead stories tended to be longer, many genre books. We know this, westerns, horror, romance, feature regular-sized comics with three or four stories each. So those stories run anywhere from, you know, 5 to 7 pages on average. But these ones more often had just two stories. The first one, anywhere from 16 to 24 pages, and then a shorter backup, maybe 6 to 10 pages. And that change of pace was noticeable. Those long stories were just more in-depth in terms of character and subplot and world-building. And like I said, that was a difference that completely stood out in terms of the Rex Allen comics from so many other Western comics that I read from that era. Tex, The Lonesome Rider, an OGN written by Italian writer Claudio Nizzi and drawn by the American legend Joe Kubert. And it's actually a simple plot. We start with a Texas Ranger, he's Tex, being thrown off a cliff to his planned death by 4 outlaws. He survives, and after recovering, tracks down each of the 4 and delivers them to justice. Justice sometimes being an arrest and a trial. Justice sometimes being delivered at the end of his smoking pistol. It's a simple story, but really well told, and needless to say, this is a beautiful comic book. And from DC, 1967, Tomahawk 108, a full story in which a new captain takes over the Rangers and does a really, really poor job leading them, eventually stepping down and agreeing to learn from Tomahawk about practical leadership skills. And from Image, a series written by John Arcudi, 2 Moons, 1 through 10. This is a series that completely leans into the weird Western concept. In Civil War times, a young soldier of Pawnee heritage is visited by visions of ghosts and demons. Some of this might be his native heritage, his role as medicine man. Some might be from the mushrooms he consumes. And that actually is a tension for a few issues, although it does become clear that others are seeing the zombie soldiers and other strange things as well. And in the midst of this new war, the spirits of the indigenous men and women killed in the previous Indian Wars rise to seek their own vengeance. Interesting story. There was an Irish nurse character who I liked, in addition to the character of Two Moons. Strange. Not fully easy to follow in terms of the narrative, but I'm pretty sure I enjoyed it. And a modern take on the weird Western, created and written by Bo Smith, as our good friend the late Sean Angle used to call him, the manliest man in comics. Wynonna Earp, 1 through 8 from IDW, 2016. I really enjoyed the Wynonna Earp TV show a lot. And this comic version had enough similarities that I could easily get into it, but with enough changes that it was still interesting. And I wasn't sure where the whole series was going. We have the same big bad as the early seasons of the TV show, Bobo, but a lot of adventures around the country, as Wynonna learns of her role as the Earp heir and also becoming a deputy within the Black Badge Agency. And then some stories taking place a few years later in that same trade, Wynonna Earp Legends 1 through 4, which included co-writing credits on 2 of the issues from the main lead actors in the series. Another good batch of issues. These ones really took the weird part of the weird Western to an altogether different level. And then vaguely related to Wynonna Earp, only in the sense that Wynonna Earp could not exist without Wyatt Earp, issue 31, a 1972 reprint of some late 50s stories. The best one here was when a younger quick draw specialist comes to town, and we learn that Wyatt's great skill comes not just from his lightning-quick reflexes and keen eyes, but also his courage. All right, that was a good collection of a wide variety of Western comics. Next month, for August, seeing as it contains the birthday of the one comic creator who is a genre all to himself, we will celebrate hashtag Jack Kirby Month. But July, of course, is not just Western Comics Month. It also has a little thing I like to call Independence Day, which is short for Independence from Martin and his English Cronies Day. And I actually have a few 4th of July related comics. Life with Archie, 172, which Sir Rob Lance sent in a while back, and I've been saving it for an appropriate time of year. This is a full-length story that starts with the Archie gang on a field trip to Washington, D.C. for the bicentennial. Archie stares at the Declaration, and in his patriotic daze, he dreams himself at various important moments during the Revolutionary era. Good story, happy 4th, and a slightly belated happy bicentennial. And a couple of quarter books I picked up years ago at the old In the Ballpark store, direct from the bicentennial era, Freedom Fighters 4 and 5. Uncle Sam and the Ray and Phantom Woman and the rest of the team are on our world, and they get on the wrong side of the NYPD in the way that they handle the challenge from the Silver Ghost. And since Diana Prince is now working at the UN, Wonder Woman spends these two issues working against, and then eventually with, the Freedom Fighters. Issue 5 has the most memorable cover of this title's 11-issue run, with Uncle Sam holding the dead asterisk body of Wonder Woman in a Pietà homage. Asterisk. Editor's note, Wonder Woman was only mostly dead, as it turns out. And also a seasonal Archie collection of a sort, in the sense of July being the heart of summer. Pep Digital 151, Jughead Grillmaster. Actually, it's not just a collection of Jughead manning the grill excellently, but as is the case with Archie stories, told over a number of decades with delightfully no regard to continuity, we also have stories of Archie as the team's grillmaster, Betty as the gang's grillmaster, and even Mr. Andrews gets into the act. For such a particular theme, they manage to tell a number of stories that go different directions. Although I must add that this 90-page or so collection had two separate stories told originally decades apart of a barbecue grill getting away from Archie and Jug and running away uncontrolled down the streets of Riverdale. It was mildly funny the first time, but I could not help laughing when I read the second story with the exact same premise. That is one of the risks you run in reading any Archie collection. And I think that's everything. In terms of my favorite reads of the month, the Nexus issue with the politician was great. I really enjoyed the issue of Tomahawk. Tex the Lonesome Rider is excellent. The Palmiotti and Gray Jonah Hex stories are terrific. But in terms of my absolute favorite, I am a sucker for teen detectives, and Goldie Vance really struck gold. I'm going with the end of the second storyline, Goldie Vance number 8, as my favorite read of the month. Next month, I'm not really sure what I'm going to be reading, other than some early FF and maybe some Cap for Jack Kirby month. But other than that, who knows? But whatever I do end up reading, I will be here to talk about those books that I read during August in an episode that ought to be out early in September. Feel free to let me know what you think of this episode, what you think of any of these books that I've mentioned. You can send that feedback via email, relativelygeeky@gmail.com, or as a comment on the Facebook and blog post for the episode. The blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. You can follow the network on Twitter at relatively_geek. And of course, the network has its own page on Facebook as well. Come join us. All are welcome. Thanks for listening, and keep the pages turning.